This is Jeff Spittler, March 26, 2000, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 18. This will be the Regency of Morton, Part 3. Good morning. I'll welcome myself back. It's good to be back. But last week I did diligently, well, kind of diligently, I half went fishing and then the other half I researched church history, so that's my free time. I did look at, well, I went to Stirling Castle, I took some photos, and I'll pass this around later, so.
What is the significance of Stirling Castle?
What is the significance of Stirling Castle? Well, that's where James the First was raised, so that...
Is that where you got patted?
Yeah. Yeah, he got his arse whipped, as they say. Yeah, that's the place. So there's not much about him, and that's also where they carried the body of his grandfather, you know, bleeding up the stairs. And although that's not, doesn't seem to be covered in the official tourist guide that I got. So, okay, well, this is the third part of the. I said Morton as regent, but maybe it would be better to say the Regency of Morton because it doesn't really revolve around him for the most part. So the last time we met 2 weeks ago, we'd covered that in April 1578, the second book of discipline had been approved by the General Assembly, been written by a committee of 40 ministers, of whom Andrew Melville was one of the members. And I tried to emphasize some of the new parts of the book of discipline. So, let's see, the first chapter dealt with the relationship between the church and the state. Chapters 2 through 8 dealt primarily with ecclesiology, the offices and office holders of the church, and the hierarchical organization of the assemblies of elders. The Kirk Session, the provincial assemblies, the national assemblies, and international assemblies. And the ninth chapter again raised this issue of patrimony of the church and its distribution, and that was as far as we got last time. Just a couple other things in here that I'd like to take a brief look at. This, by the way, is available online, and if you go to the class webpage, you can find a link to this document. The pictures aren't online yet, but I've got some to add, so we'll start increasing the photos on the website. Also, the other thing we're going to discuss today is George Buchanan's book, De Jure Regne Apud Scotos, or however you say it. And that's also, there's also a link to two versions of that. So, Chapter 10 is called Of the Office of a Christian Magistrate in the Kirk. And this is, in terms of the relationship between the two kingdoms, this is a fairly important chapter. There's seven paragraphs. And let's see, maybe I should, may not read through all of them, but I think to give you an idea here, let's see, number one. Although all the members of the Kirk are held, everyone in his vocation, and according thereto to advance the kingdom of Jesus Christ so far as lies in their power, yet chiefly Christian princes and other magistrates are held to do the same. For they are called in the Scriptures nourishers of the Kirk, for so much as by them it is, or at least ought to be, maintained, fostered, upheld, and defended against all that would procure the hurt thereof. So it pertains to the number two. So it pertains to the office of a Christian magistrate to assist and fortify the godly proceedings of the Kirk in all behalfs, and namely to see that the public estate and ministry thereof be maintained and sustained as it appertains according to God's word. Sure. To see that the Kirk be not invaded nor hurt by false teachers and hirelings, nor the rooms thereof be occupied by dumb dogs or idle bellies. Okay, and so this is certainly the civil magistrate was at that time doing or trying to do things in its power to essentially occupy those rooms with dumb dogs and idle bellies. To assist and maintain the discipline of the Kirk and punish them civilly that will not obey the censure of the same, always without confounding the one jurisdiction with the other. They're to see, this is number five, to see that sufficient provision is made for the ministry, the schools, and the poor, and if they have not sufficient to wait upon their charges, to supply their indigence with their own rents if need require, to hold hand as well to the saving of their persons from injury and open violence. As to their rents and possessions, that they not be defrauded, robbed, nor spoiled thereof. Let's see. Not to suffer the patrimony of the Kirk to be applied to profane and unlawful uses. Right, this was a common problem. Or be devoured by idle bellies, and such as have no lawful function in the Kirk, to the hurt of the ministry, schools, poor, and other godly uses, whereupon the same ought to be bestowed. Okay. So that's the first six, and they would, I guess, primarily have to do with, you know, not messing with the church and not and sort of upholding justice. Seventh paragraph is related to the laws, which is somewhat interesting. To make the laws and constitutions agreeable to God's word for advancement of the Kirk and policy thereof, without usurping anything that pertains not to the civil sword, but belongs to the offices that are merely ecclesiastical, as are the ministry of the word and sacraments, using of ecclesiastical discipline, and the spiritual execution thereof, or any part of the power of the spiritual keys which our Master gave the apostles and their true successors. And, although kings and princes that are godly, sometimes by their own authority when the Kirk is corrupt, and all things out of order, place ministers and restore the true service of the Lord, after the example of some godly kings of Judah, and diverse godly emperors and kings also in the light of the New Testament. Yet where the ministry of the Kirk is once lawfully constituted, and they are placed to do their office faithfully, all godly princes and magistrates ought to hear and obey their voice, and reverence the majesty of the Son of God speaking by them. Okay, so, I mean, the sort of separation, biblical separation between church and state is maintained throughout this chapter, but nevertheless, I think we see there's some fair, significant role envisaged for the civil magistrate to assist the church, sort of within its station, within its power. Okay, the remaining, let's see, three chapters. Chapter 11, of the present abuses remaining in the Kirk which we desire to be reformed. We've really covered many of these things in here, including things like giving benefices to men also unmeet, or rather more unmeet, who are not minded to serve in the Kirk. Things related to bishops and whether or not, bishops may be more than just pastors, and of course the answer here is they may not. Things relating to patrimony and so on. Let's see, the 12th chapter, certain special heads of reformation which we crave. Again, parts of it deal specifically with abuses like settling a benefice for multiple churches on a single pastor, or not settling the benefice but a portion of the benefice and retaining the rest. And so sort of, you know, instead of having one minister per parish, having one minister for three or four parishes. With respect to assemblies, it says, paragraph 7, likewise concerning provincial and synodal assemblies, consideration were easy to be taken, how many and in what places they were to be held, and how often they should convene, ought to be referred to the liberty of the general Kirk in order to be appointed therein. So in other words, the church should be able to set its own assemblies. And that, in, you know, James is already king at this point, but when he becomes of age, this will be a way that he uses to control the church by setting the assemblies, or in many cases not setting any assemblies. So again, national assemblies of this country, called commonly the general assemblies, ought always to be retained in their own liberty and have their own place, with power to the Kirk to appoint times and places convenient for the same, and all men, magistrates as well as inferiors, to be subject to the judgment of the same in ecclesiastical causes, without any reclamation or appellation to any judge, civil or ecclesiastical, within the realm. Okay, so the General Assembly ought to be able to set its own time, and it should not be interfered with by the civil magistrate. The liberty of the election of persons called to the ecclesiastical functions, and observed without interruption so long as the Kirk was not corrupted by Antichrist, we desire to be restored and retained within this realm, so that none be intruded upon any congregation, either by the prince or any inferior person, without lawful election in the assent of the people over whom the person is placed. So again, this issue of placing pastors in churches by the civil magistrate is, liberty is denied here. Finally, chapter 13 talks about the benefits of the Reformation, and the title of the chapter is "The Utility That Shall Flow from This Reformation to All Estates." So, might not be the words we would choose today, but okay. Okay, so this was approved in 1578. For several years, the General Assembly sort of worked out some of the details of this within their own sphere. So they passed acts that required the bishops be pastors of only one congregation, and that they submit themselves to the General Assembly or they be subject to excommunication. The Bishop of Dunblane was in one of those assemblies and submitted himself. Yes, question.
If the bishops were just associated with one congregation, in what way were they different from the normal pastor?
That was their point. They weren't different from the normal pastor. So, and they might have been appointed by the civil magistrate as a bishop, and the church was willing to sort of countenance that as long as they completely were subservient to the definition of a bishop being just the pastor of one congregation. So, they might have had some benefits or something like that, but yeah, basically the church forced them to just be pastors if they were suitable.
So did they continue to appoint new bishops?
Well, they did up until for another year or so, and then they butted heads on that. The church said that the General Assembly passed an act. Let's see. Well, sometime in 1578, so they barred further ordination of any bishops. And that was sort of the first interaction James had with the church, as he wrote a letter telling them. Let's see, he wrote a letter, he actually had an act of council telling them they couldn't enforce that act, but they ignored them anyways. Okay, well, in January of 1579, George Buchanan, who was at that point still James's tutor, he published a book. He'd apparently written it somewhat earlier. It was apparently written about the time that Mary was deposed. And the Latin title is De Jure Regne Apud Scotos, which has been translated in various ways: Laws for the Kings of Scotland, The Powers of the Crown in Scotland. I asked Sarah to translate it. It was a lot more humorous than that, but so. Otto Scott describes this, and this is sort of another great quote. It's a much more exciting writer than myself. So. Let's see. It was an astonishing work, a piece that tolled like a great bell through time, that was, in the end, to bring down all the House of Stuart, the Bourbons and the Habsburgs, the Hohenzollerns and the Romanovs, the entire structure of kingly power. In 1579, it rang as shocking as a scream in the night. The fame of the author was assisted by the Calvinist diaspora, which operated from Geneva and whose influence spread not only all across Northern Europe, but even into Constantinople. The dream of the leaders of this movement was to smash the power of the Vatican and reunite all Christendom into a new doctrine in which laymen would control the clergy, but both would work together in a God-oriented new society. At least part of this dream was attractive to the Jewish diaspora, and the Calvinists received some cooperation from the Sephardic refugees from Spain who had established themselves as commercially important in the Netherlands, Germany, and Portugal. Written in Socratic dialogue, De Jure argued that the that political power ultimately belongs to the people, and that all society consists of a series of social contracts involving mutual obligations and restraints that bind both rulers and people. The rights of the people, as expressed in a majority, should prevail. If a tyrant abuses that understanding, the people have a right to resist, to overthrow, and to punish. It was Buchanan's great accomplishment to be able to state these themes in the language of Europe's scholars as the leading voice of the humanist movement, a term then applied to classicists who had broken the bonds of their predecessors, to the works of Aristotle, and who instead ranged across the spectrum of learned antiquity. By being able to do that, Buchanan sounded a theme upon which the world of northern scholars, poets, literati, scientists, the politically restless and the ambitious, the Calvinist and the Jewish diaspora could all unite. No more significant revolutionary contribution has ever been made. Knox's doctrines were renewed and revitalized. Buchanan created this masterstroke 100 years before Hobbes and 200 years before Rousseau, took its themes, by then afloat in the air, to write his social contract. By that time, Buchanan's name had faded like the Latin in which he wrote. In 1579, however, it might well have been written in the sky over Europe. New editions of De Jure began to pour from the presses. So, in some sense, after reading that, I could just, you know, stop and go on to the next topic. That's a pretty good summary. A little bit from it we'll talk about. Again, it was written earlier. When it was published, it was when he published it, it was 1579. It was dedicated to James VI. And let's see if I can. There's about a 5-paragraph letter to James, which is at the beginning. And the last two read as follows. I know, moreover, that your nature ever impels you to avoid that nourisher of tyrants and disease of legitimate governments, flattery, and that you dislike the absurdities and artificial customs of court no less than you do those persons who appear to despise everything which is in good taste, and who love and practice such absurdities and customs, who season their speech with such terms as your majesty, my lord, your excellency, and other expressions even more disgusting. Although your natural goodness and the correctness of your principles protect you for the present from these ills, I am nonetheless apprehensive lest that suave wet nurse of vice, bad company, turn your tender mind in the worst direction, and I am especially so because I'm not unaware of the ease with which our senses present us with temptations. I therefore present this book to you not merely as a guide, but also as an exacting critic, one even lacking at times in respect, which in the age while your disposition is plastic, may go with you through the dangers of flattery, not only to show you the way, but also, once you have entered upon it, to keep you in it, to check you or draw you back if you would stray. If you persevere in the way which this book shows you, you will procure for yourself and your people peace in this life, and in the life to come, eternal glory. Obviously, Buchanan is a bit sarcastic here. This is exactly what happens to James, is that he does fall subject to flattery, to bad company, and so on. So I don't believe this is coincidental. In fact, within the year, things will change wholeheartedly. James will actually leave in October. He'll leave Stirling, not to return to live there. Go live in Edinburgh. Yes. Question.
Was Buchanan's theme just law and democracy? I mean, that's what Adam Scott made it sound like power to the people, majority rule.
No, I wouldn't take it that far. The it was partly a reaction to Machiavellian politics that had become commonplace and, you know, influential in the French court, and then in turn in the Scottish court through Mary, and through it will become common through the influence that James is going to fall under. So, but he does, let me get to this in a second. It is written in Socratic dialogue, so it's Buchanan is one of the dialecticians, or one of the speakers, and then the other one is Thomas Maitland, the younger brother of William Maitland. Dan's question about whether or not it was raw democracy is kind of interesting. I think if you look at the basis of it, I mean, Scott's already mentioned this, that he broken free from the bonds of Aristotle and had ranged across antiquity. That's true. If you read this, you'll see there's heavy... it doesn't read like a Knoxian tract. I mean, it reads... It is in the language of, you know, say, the humanists of the day. Primarily, it does reuse the Bible. But just to give you a little flavor of it... let's see, it's also heavy on natural law. Okay, but it's not... It's sort of a blend. I mean, different things, he goes different places, but he goes to history quite a bit, and classical history. Let's see, this is... It's broken up as a series of sections. Although that may have been... I guess the sections may have actually been... Or chapters may have been added by the translator. Let's see. So this is, it says, Maitland, I am in substantial agreement with you. However, you use the word nature, which I employ more as a habit of speech than because of any clear concept which I have. The term is used in such a variety of contexts and of so many things that I am puzzled as to what meanings I may attach to it. Okay. Buchanan, for the purposes of the present discussion, I wish it understood only as it means the light divinely shed upon our minds. For when God formed the animal made in his own image, endowed with reason, and gave him dominion over the beasts, he not only gave him the physical senses, by the use of which he can avoid all that endangers him, and can maintain situations favorable to his well-being, but he also created in his spirit a light by which he distinguishes between good and evil. Some call this ability nature, and others the law of nature. I regard it as truly divine, and convinced that nature never says the one thing and reason the contrary. Furthermore, God has given us a summary which comprises the whole law in a few words. We should love him with all our souls and our neighbors as ourselves. Herein are contained all the rules of the Holy Scriptures which deal with moral conduct. Other than this is merely elaboration. So you can sort of see this almost in this, you know, a few paragraphs, this sort of blending of natural law and biblical revelation. Mr. Brucato.
I will only take this question for the end.
Good. Okay. No, would you like to go ahead if you like? The way you lean back, I had a feeling you're going to ask a deep question, so.
Well, it sounds like that's a fairly big error that you just made right there that probably would not come to fruition for a long time. I mean, it's not going to be readily apparent to the Christians, the compromise that was just made right there.
Well, I think you probably have to, I know what you're saying. You know, if we use natural law as the basis, right? Then we have.
I think it goes even a little bit deeper than that. He just made a compromise with rationalism. Not the superiority of man's intellect. That God gave us these things.
Yeah.
The fact is, we don't know those things. We can't know to love God and to love our neighbors as ourselves without the help of the Holy Spirit.
Right.
But he writes in such a way that the non-Christians.
Yeah, probably it's not really fair to sort of draw a judgment based on a little excerpt that I read, but there may be that, Rob. I mean, it's certainly he does a lot of it does come from natural law. I mean, that I don't.
To me, that stands to reason is that he would rely on natural law. I don't think that that's a good thing to use.
Yeah, but it doesn't solely rely on natural law, and there's quite a bit of biblical.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
Well.
Well, it is. Adapting the ability of man's intellect to figure these things out. I mean, it's in direct contrast to presuppositionalism.
I think it's a bigger question, but I mean, it's well worth discussing. But let's not.
It's just him alone.
Let's pass on that for the moment. Come back to it. let's see, just an example in terms of more biblical biblical perspective. It's responding to Maitland. Let's see if I can find this. Okay, Maitland had said, granting these points, the writings of Paul urge us strongly to pray for the safety of princes. Let's see, Buchanan then says, you do well, in my opinion, to give so much weight to the authority of Paul that one sentence from him outweighs all the writings of the philosophers and legal experts. But see to it that you weigh his words with sufficient care. So, I mean, he's right here said that the one sentence of Paul outweighs all the philosophers and legal experts. For it is important not only to look closely at his works, but also at his times, and to whom and for what purpose he wrote. Let us first see what Paul wrote. For he wrote to Titus, chapter 3, put them in mind to be subject to principalities and powers, to obey magistrates, and to be ready in all good works. You see, I think, the limits which Paul sets to the obligation to obey. He wrote in the second chapter of the Epistle to Timothy to the same effect, that we pray for all men, especially for kings and other rulers, in order, he says, that we may lead a quiet life in all godliness and honesty. And here you see the purpose of our prayers as he describes it. It is not only the safety of kings, but the peace of the church, from which it is not difficult to conceive the form of the prayer. In the Epistle to the Romans, he defines a ruler with a precision almost equal to that of formal logic. For he says, the ruler is a minister to whom God has entrusted the sword, that he may punish evildoers and assist and support the good. For as Chrysostom, however you say that, says, is it Chrysostom, the church father? Paul was not writing of tyrants, but of true and lawfully appointed rulers who are God's true vice-regents on earth. Anyone who resists them does indeed resist God's ordinances. Okay, but on the other hand, although it is our duty to pray for bad princes, we ought not to conclude from this that their crimes ought not to be punished. They should no more be immune to punishment than are the robbers for whom we are commanded to pray. Nor does it follow from the fact that good rulers ought to be obeyed, that bad ones ought not to be resisted. When you study the condition which impelled Paul to write, take care that this passage is not misunderstood. For he was writing for the purpose of rebuking a particular erroneous attitude on the part of some persons who denied that governmental authority extended to Christians. They, the antinomians, maintained that inasmuch as government should be provided as an agent for holding evildoers in check, in order that we may all live under impartial justice, and that an example of divine justice should continue among men, political authority is of no value for those persons who are unaffected by the vices, for they are a law unto themselves. Paul, in consequence, is not pleading for those persons who exercise political authority, but for political authority itself. That is, the functions and duties of those who rule over others. Okay. Well, he goes on from there, but I think that gives you a flavor of the, you know, there's sort of a mixed basis. He uses more than, it's not purely sort of from a natural law, nor purely from a biblical perspective. I guess he uses arguments from both. He introduces, establishes, and defends a number of theses related to the civil magistrate. Get a rough idea. This just comes from the table of contents. So rulers may properly be held accountable for their acts. The all-inclusive function of government is the maintenance of justice. Kings derive their authority from the consent of the governed. The law is the ideal of the perfectly just ruler. The Scots, history shows that the Scots have consistently held their kings to account for the legality of their acts. Covers grounds upon which rulers may justly be deposed. He contends that limited monarchies are more stable than absolutisms. Goes to Scottish history for proof that Scotland has always had a government of laws, a limited and constitutional government. He explores and defends the principle of the independence of the judiciary and of the vital importance of judicial review. He develops the principle of the equality of accused persons before a court of law. He argues the right of a people to overthrow their government and stand upon their freedom under the law of nature. And This was the title. Again, the title chapter here was chosen by the translator. So I read this chapter and couldn't really find good evidence for this. But he says he entitled it "Rebellion to Tyrants is Obedience to God." But in fact, when I read I was kind of disappointed when I read the chapter because it wasn't really in there. So sorry, wishful thinking maybe. I don't know. So, anyways, again, my point isn't to declare Buchanan as being the end all of political reasoning or anything like that, but just merely to show historically that this was to have sort of a profound effect on Scottish politics. Vicky.
He also writing in response to their view of the divine right of kings.
Yes, I mean definitely. In fact, well, I mean, he deals with that explicitly a number of places, because in fact, Maitland contends basically the divine right of kings, and then he rebuts that actually from the Bible several places, that from Paul and so on, that that for instance, that you should basically, in terms of church discipline, you shouldn't have anything to do with someone who has guilty of certain sort of heinous sins, and applies that to the king. It's difficult to categorize. Let's see, my copy here. This came off the web. Is 54 pages of double spaced text. So it's fairly lengthy. Treatise. It's a bit difficult to characterize solely on that. Not to mention, it's written in the 16th century, but it might. We'll save a discussion for later on. Okay, so I guess I got ahead of myself here, but in 1578, after they approved of this book of discipline, the General Assembly took several actions against the bishops, and this finally, the king, who was then 13, attempted to stop the church from excommunicating some of the bishops through an act of council. And I don't know how much, at his age he may have been persuaded by Morton, it's hard to say. But in any case, the church went on. They ignored the act of council. So, okay, but I mentioned already in the introduction to the book about flattery and bad company. Well, he's about to get it here. On the 15th of September, 1579, Esme Stuart, the Seigneur d'Aubigny, arrives from France. He was 37 years old. He was a cousin of the king. He came to, quote, pay his respects to the king. He was reputed to be an agent of the Duke of Guise. As far as I can tell, he was, but his appearance was quite spectacular. He was richly attired. He had an escort of 20 gentlemen. He was carrying a present of 6 fine blooded horses from the Duke of Guise, and he carried with him 40,000 crowns of gold. That, according to Otto Scott, is more money than Elizabeth had spent dealing with Scotland in her entire reign. So, and he threw this money around quite profligately. He flattered and fondled his way into James's heart, who is now 13. And I think most of you probably know this, that James was a homosexual. This would apparently be where it began. The King James Bible, yeah. You know that the reason why he did that was to get rid of the Geneva Bible with all its notes, right? I say this: I think you could probably go to like one of these King James only websites, and they would probably say, no, he wasn't a homosexual, because of course there isn't any like absolute proof, like photographs or something like that. But if you read what he wrote later in life to some of his court favorites, it definitely gives every impression of, I don't see, it seems difficult that you could read it any other way. So, he called Duke of Buckingham his wife. That's what it appears.
Did he marry?
He did marry, and he did have children, yeah. So.
Now, a bisexual?
I don't know. Okay, well, in any case, I mean, he was at least, in this case, observed in public, being very intimate with the Seigneur d'Aubigné. In October 1579, after he'd been there a few weeks, James rode to Edinburgh to sit over the Parliament. Morton had gone to great personal expense to have a lavish reception for James, however, the appearance of Esme Stuart was an eventuality that he wasn't prepared for. In fact, at the Parliament, James received these estates confiscated from the Hamilton family. And this is, I'm assuming that they were confiscated for their part in fighting the King's party earlier. But he immediately gave the best estates to Esme Stuart. This alarmed Morton and the church, and that there were rumors that James was converting to Catholicism. I guess you'll see it didn't quite work out that way. But so from then, James remained at Holyrood House in Edinburgh. And besides Esme Stuart and Captain James Stuart, who is said to be a bold, unprincipled, licentious man, capable of any crime and possessing considerable craft in devising, as well as daringness in executing his ambitious designs, a number of other nobles gathered round him, including the Earl of Argyll and Lord Seton and Livingston. Okay, to say the least, this group would not have had a positive influence on the young king. Certainly, Captain James Stuart was reputed to have been encouraging the king in all kinds of vice. The court around him, this was Buchanan call it the wet nurse of bad company. I mean, it was definitely not a good situation. In March 1580, he made Esme Stuart the Earl of Lennox, and the church was assured that the king was converting him to Protestantism. He did officially become a Protestant. And whether this was part of some prearranged Guisean plan, or that Esme Stuart would allow himself to be converted, because this happened through this long series of discussions, or whether he was somehow perceived it to be advantageous to himself, it's difficult to say. In any case, the testimony of the church might have been a bit muted because of this purported conversion. Yeah. Right. In other words, they may have either been fooled by it, or at least, you know, he made a plausible profession of faith, whatever. So, one of Elizabeth's diplomats, Sir Robert Bowes, he appeared at court to offer James proof that Esme Stuart was in the pay of the Duke of Guise. James refused to listen to the evidence unless Esme Stuart was present, so Bowes left without presenting his proofs. Elizabeth encouraged Morton to take action, military action. So he started to, and then she waffled. And so he'd started to gather his forces, and then she waffled as to whether or not she would support him with troops. So this word got around and alarmed James, but Esme Stuart offered to take care of it. And they wove a rather sophisticated net around Morton. They brought back, I think it was Sir James Douglas, a witness from France, to testify that 13 years earlier, Morton had known of the plot to kill Darnley, but had done nothing to stop it. So he received a trial in May of 1581. He was judged by all these people who really hated him. And he was judged to have been guilty of, quote, art and part of the murder of King Henry. And he vociferously protested, but he was executed on the 2nd of June, 1581. So, thus ends the regency of Morton. The king, there's also some very suspicious stuff. I think on the 30th of December or something like that, the king invited him to go hunting and treated Morton very nicely and made some florid statement about how he would defend the Earl of Morton. And somebody else that was there warned him to flee, and he didn't believe it because the king was, you know, seemed very positive and everything. And the next day he was arrested. So, okay, that's as far as we're going today. Questions, discussion? Bob, or Mike.
What business does the church have ever listening to really you would say a child? In all the places in the Bible are talked about the ignorance of youth, someone speaks about youth in a negative way. Bringing up youth in a way that God knows. But what business does the church ever have allowing a child to put their child up what it should do?
I don't think. Specifically, in which case, though?
For instance, you know, him protesting the bishops and things like that.
Yeah, they didn't listen.
You know, until you reach X number of age, you should say, you have nothing to say, you're just a baby.
Well, they did do that. In fact, as we'll see in another year or so, he's kidnapped and thrown in a castle with new guardians. And one of them said it was better that bairns should weep than men with beards. So, that wasn't the church, but so, yeah, I don't know. They didn't have. I mean, they ignored that act of council anyway. So, but it, I mean, it would have been officially sanctioned not by himself but by the council. So,
so they were heading toward, it looks like, some sort of separation of church and state. They were trying to pull this thing apart in some sense. But I mean, it seems to me that they haven't gone far enough yet.
Well, yeah, I mean,
why should you worry about whether the king is a Protestant or a Catholic if he's really a pagan? Who cares? He shouldn't be in the church anyway.
But, well, I think that's probably where they're. If you read, you know, look at the second book of discipline, that's, you know, I mean, I think they could excommunicate the king. That clearly they could, but nevertheless, what we're going to see is that they're going to struggle for power with him. He's going to keep trying to run the church. The one of the things that's said of this Esme Stuart and so on was regaling in the tales of the sort of absolute power of the French monarchs, you know, and how they use bishops to accomplish their ends and so on. Don't know if that's, you know, true, but that's apparently what he, one of the things, that, one of the lessons that James learned was that. So,
The reason James was so concerned about controlling the church, was it just because was this leftover from the right of King God to control the church, or was there any real, was there really a power base there?
Well, I've thought about that question. The question being whether, you know, it seems to me that James's life would have been a lot easier if he just said, fine, you know, do your thing, I'll do mine, and, you know, and so on. So I can't really, I mean, you know, you're trying to search the human heart to know what his motivations were to, because I mean the church wasn't trying to rebel against his authority as a civil magistrate. They just didn't want him interfering with the church. Like,
have you come across any sermons where the preacher is preaching against it?
Not yet. No.
Do you think the ministers didn't know about it, or they just were the
Well, only two choices there. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Well, I guess